Hey, it's Andrew here, and welcome to the Ecom Fuel Podcast, the show dedicated to helping seven and eight-figure brand owners build incredible businesses and amazing lives. And today on the show, I had a blast talking with Walt Wimmer, who is the CEO of Tom's Off-Road. Walt's a relatively new member in the ECF community, came in and immediately noticed him for just all the value and knowledge he was dropping. Got a chance to meet him at ECF Live recently, deeply enjoyed talking with him, and had to have him on the show. And we talk about a lot of stuff. He has been in the vintage Ford Bronco market for years, as we'll talk about. Family business that he helped run as a kid, came back and took the reins of as CEO more recently. We talk about a lot of stuff. We talk about designing good comp plans for your team, how to think about that, what goes into that. We talk about, they have built up a phenomenal network of top-notch quality manufacturing partners, both in the U.S. and overseas. So we talk about how they've been able to do that, you know, manage quality control, the complexity, the difficulties, and the wonderful parts of running a business with a ton of SKUs. We get into that. Lots of great takeaways here, but we started off by completely geeking out about vintage 4x4 rigs, Broncos, vans, just the market in general, full restorations. It's a lot of fun if you like classic cars, not classic cars, kind of more retro vehicles, especially in the 4x4 market. If that is your jam, stick around for the first 20 minutes. If not, you might want to skip to 20-ish minutes or so where we start getting into the geeky business parts. But regardless, hope you enjoy it. I did, and we'll get into it right now. Well, so we're going to get into marketing. We're going to get into compensation. We're going to get into all of the things that will help people blow up their business and, you know, change the world and make bajillion dollars. But I want to talk about first cool cars. I mean, we got to start there with your story. Talk a little bit about the car that you really regret selling.
So that's an easy question to answer because there's only been one car I've regret selling, and that's because I've only sold one Bronco. So my first car was a 1976 Bronco that my dad helped track down and buy. And what we did is I had to save up whatever I saved up for the car, my parents would match. So this would have been back in 2003, and it was a $7,000 Bronco. So I put up $3,500 and my parents matched it, which was a great idea. And I think we're going to do the same thing with our kids. But anyways, back then a $7,000 Bronco is much nicer than it would be today.
Oh, it's like a $15,000 or $20,000 Bronco, probably.
Yeah, well, if you got a Bronco for $7,000 today, you're probably just using it for the frame, and it's probably not going to be running, and it's also going to have tons of rust, tons of holes all over the place. So yeah, it was really fun getting that car because I drove it all throughout high school. It was just really fun to drive, taking the top off in the summer times. A lot of great memories driving with my family and friends in it, and then it was really fun. I got to fix it up with my dad throughout high school. And so by the end of high school, I was going to college, University of Oregon. It's a little bit of a drive from Southern Oregon. So my dad kind of encouraged me, talked to me about maybe you should sell it and get something a little bit more, you know, easy to maintain. And I was like, okay. And little did you know that, you know, the prices of Broncos were just going to continue to skyrocket. So that was the biggest regret. And so thankfully, about 3 years ago, I had bought another Bronco. So I have a 1971 Bronco. So my wife is very nice, and we have an agreement where we will always have at least one Bronco in our household.
This was the paperwork right after the proposal. You're exactly, like, hey, I love you, baby. Now that we got just a few small logistical details, my lawyer's here. Yep. He's very nice. I imagine even before, apart from the price increase, the thing that probably is even harder, don't you love if I'm just starting with this trauma right out of the gates, just to, you know, really, you know, just dive deep, open up the scar tissue. It's probably like the memories and the nostalgia you have from that first vehicle.
Oh yeah, definitely. It's something that you can't replicate. And it's really fun, even though, you know, I have a different year of an early Bronco, it's still similar in a lot of ways. So anytime, I'm not making this up, but like literally every time I get into my 71 Bronco, there's always memories that come back from my first car, from my 76 Bronco. And it just feels like home. And I think that is part of the reason why classic cars in general and also the early Broncos have stuck around, and there's such an affinity for them because people just like me, they made memories with those Broncos with, you know, their dad, their siblings, their friends, or whoever it may be. So it's the same thing where it's these generational memories and experiences you get to pass down to the next generation. So it's one of those common things you get to hear that people I just randomly meet in parking lots. It happens all the time. And I can always tell when someone's coming over to talk to me about my Bronco, they just have a look in their eyes, but it's always like, oh man, this was my first car. Or, oh, this was my best friend's first car growing up, or whatever it may be. Like, it just evokes so much emotions and memories. And I think that's something that's really special that it's much harder to find about modern cars today.
Yeah, it's so interesting how there is these certain cars, like the Bronco is one that we were talking before. We have this old 1990 VW van that has, you know, same thing. We'll go driving around. You pull up to a gas station and you chat with people. Like, so many fun conversations. It's been a really fun adventure vehicle for our family. And then other vehicles don't have it. Like the 1990s era Ford Tauruses don't have exactly a cult following, right? Like,
yeah.
And part of it is the build quality, but there's also something else. What do you think it is about the Bronco that has made it so endearing to so many people?
Yeah, I think, you know, it was at the time, like, there wasn't too many cars offered where you could, you know, take, it was so off-road capable right off the factory floor. Like, you didn't need to do anything to it to take it off-roading. You know, obviously, if you're getting more into like rock crawling and more technical things, yes, there are going to be some things you need to do, but it was so capable. And I think also it allowed, you know, people with kids to, you know, it was also could be a family vehicle. It could be a hunting vehicle. It could be a work vehicle, a farm vehicle. So it was really versatile. And I think that's something that is, that was really appealing, where it was like, hey, this is, you know, it gives you more of, it's not just a car, but a sense of adventure. And it's more about, like, it becomes part of your identity as opposed to just a physical object. It really, you know, it becomes part of the family in a way.
Yeah. Did you see they're bringing the Scout back as well?
I did. Yes. I think it's awesome. I think it's going to be really interesting. Like, there's been talks about it. I don't know what is actually going to happen, but there's been talks about Ford, you know, coming out with an EV Bronco. We'll see if that happens. They're probably watching very closely to what happens with the Scout. But yeah, I think Scout knocked it out of the park because it still looks very close to the classic Scout. And also just really intrigued by, you know, just going from the get-go, making it 100% electric.
Oh, I didn't know the Scout was 100% electric.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It is. Yep.
Very cool. Thoughts on the new Bronco? I actually feel like I'll kind of bias the jury here a little bit. Sometimes they'll redo a vehicle and you look at it and you're like, no, you totally botched it. What do you? But I feel like they got, I'm not, the small Broncos, like this Bronco Sports, not a fan. But the legit full-size Broncos they relaunched, I've never driven one, but just completely from an aesthetics perspective, they look awesome. So I don't know if the mechanicals are there or like everything else, you know, more than I do, but it seems like they did a decent job from the outside.
Yeah, I agree. And like, it's funny you bring up the Bronco Sport. It's one of those things where it really, they rebranded kind of the Ford Escape.
Yeah.
But I also understand it's like, you know, they wanted to offer a vehicle at a more entry-friendly price point for a lot of customers. So, you know, we still see Bronco Sports out of events. We still include them in the Bronco family. But yes, they are definitely a different looking car than the new Bronco and the classic Bronco. But, you know, they are fun to drive. I've driven one. And then also the new Broncos, one of our work vehicles is actually, it's a 2023 four-door Ford Bronco. So we'll drive it to events. We'll use it for marketing purposes. And then a lot of times, our R&D team will use my 1971 Bronco for R&D, like test fitting, product test fitting. And also sometimes they'll leave the parts on there. I'll drive it around and give them feedback. So when my 71 Bronco's in the shop, I'll drive the 2023 four-door Bronco. And yeah, I agree with you. The design, at first, I was a little like, I don't know. Like, I wish it looked a little bit more like the early Bronco. But then when I saw the two-door design, I was like, okay, that is really cool. And as you can, you know, supply and demand always, you know, it's the ultimate test if something is successful. And it's just, they were such high demand and such short supply. Part of that was the pandemic as well when they first came out. But, you know, slowly that supply is catching up with demand. But it's like, you can't go out for a drive and not see a new Ford Bronco. It's getting impossible. Like, no matter where you live, they're everywhere.
You could be a diplomat wallet. You're like, how do I share my thoughts on the sport without alienating 20% of our customer base here?
In case any Bronco sports drivers are listening or someone who works at Ford.
You're going to email me after the fact. Yes. Like, great interview. No. We got to take the part of the sport out. Yeah. We got to cut that. Have the editors cut it. Last question on the car geekery side, and then we'll get into the business stuff. But restorations, like, you're 71. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Did you restore it from the ground up? And I asked because the van that we have, you're talking about, like, that there's so much nostalgia. They're almost always not the most comfortable vehicles to drive, but there's a lot of beauty in the memories, in kind of the heritage of them, in the workability. They're usually easier to wrench on. They're built really well. Sometimes the functionality you just can't get. Like, our van, there's things it can do from a layout and a living perspective, and even off-road perspective, in the package that I've really struggled to find for another modern vehicle. Because I went for like 18 months being like, oh my gosh, if I having to repair this thing every 6 months, their trips are so fun when they work well, but when they don't, they're a nightmare.
Yeah.
And anyway, I got to the point recently where something broke and I'm just like, I'm done. We're either selling this or, like, ground up doing a full-on mechanical restoration, new engine, drivetrain, everything. Yeah. So I'm in the process of kind of early specking that with a shop. So, but it is a commitment in time. It's a commitment in money. So you're 71. Have you done a full restoration? What's your thoughts on that? Like, when to do it? I was asking you a little bit about this at dinner.
Yeah. Yeah. So I always like to say restoration, when it comes to a classic car, it's very similar to a house that you move into, and there's like, oh, these are the things that we need to do. We're going to redo the kitchen. We're going to redo the bathroom. Those other things can wait. So this is the most important thing. And then it's just like, you never really stop improving. It's one of those things where I always tell customers, like, or people who are looking to buy a Bronco or any classic car, and being like, okay, well, what's your goal? What are your objectives with this build? Because if it's something like, oh, I want to learn the ins and out of the Bronco, how everything works together, it's like, okay, you could be like a good candidate for like a ground up restoration. And then, you know, the next question I usually ask is like, what's your timeline and what's your budget? Because those are also important things to kind of give the scope of like what's reasonable. Because if you're doing it yourself, it takes a lot of time and it takes a lot of money. But at the end of the day, you have exactly what you want and something that's going to be way more valuable than, you know, something that's not fully restored. So with my 71 Bronco, it was in decent driving shape when I got it. So, like, there wasn't a whole lot I needed to do from the get-go to be able to drive it, but it did have a lot of stock features on it. And my whole goal with my build of my Bronco is I want it to still look classic and stock, but to have more some of the creature comforts and more modern capabilities in terms of drivability, in terms of safety. So some of the first things that we did is it had the stock drum brakes, so we replaced them with the power disc brakes. And it's like night and day, where it's like, you know, you're pushing the pedal like 10 times to stop 100 yards before you need to stop. So, like, now with the power disc brakes, it feels very much more like a modern car, and you can stop really quick and safely. And then, like, a lot of times through the years, people have cut out the rear fenders and their Bronco to allow for greater clearance with their tires, so they can put on bigger tires or, you know, get a lift, and that way it's more capable off-road, or, you know, some people do it just for looks. But so original uncut Broncos are becoming more valuable because there's just less of them around. So I was very fortunate that the Bronco I bought has uncut fenders. So with my 76 in high school, not knowing what I know now, not being as wise, I was like, oh, first thing, I cut the fenders out. And so my 71, it's like, I'm not cutting the fenders out. And then, like, another thing, for example, like, you know, like a modern upgrade is we sell really cool PSC power steering boxes, and we swapped that out. And now it feels like when you're driving an old classic car, you can kind of feel like you're almost driving a bus, where you turn the wheel but nothing turns. Or you have to constantly, if you're going straight, you have to go left and right on the wheel to keep going straight. So the power steering box allows you, it's like a much tighter feeling, and it helps with alignment, and it just helps give you a better overall feel for the car. And then there's just some other things that we've been like testing out like backup cameras, things like that, integrating more of, you know, touchscreens into the dashboard so you can have Apple CarPlay or Google Play, things like that. So it's one of those things. I'm not going full on restoration. I've thought about it, doing that maybe with like another Bronco someday, but this one is more, I want it to be a daily driver, something that it looks great, something that's comfortable to drive, that's safe. And then it's really fun to drive with our dog and with my wife and my kids too. So they enjoy it too. So it's something really, right now it's like it can still get dirty. The kids can do whatever they want on the inside of the car. And it's like, it's not this like showroom quality Bronco that I have to, you know, buff every Sunday. So that's also a nice thing. Like if it gets some dings or some dents, it's no big deal.
Yeah. It's with our restoration that we're doing, we looked at potentially doing like, you know, full on strip down to the metal.
Yeah.
Get all the imperfections gone, repaint, you know, all this kind of stuff. And we decided against it, one, because it was going to take forever. Two, it was going to be insanely expensive. But three, I was like, dude, I want to be able to take this vehicle up gnarly roads and through bushes. And like, I want to use it. And I, with kids, nothing ruins the experience for a kid of being like, no, okay, I just got away from the car. You didn't touch it. Yeah. Right. It ruins. That's not why you get it. So,
yeah.
And it is funny to see how different people, some people are purists. They're like, listen, don't molest anything. I want it to look like it just rolled off. I'm definitely not. I'm like, oh, just, you know, any purist would throw open their mouth when they see the finished version of what we're doing. So, and you got me rethinking too, the cutting the wheel wells out, because that's something we're doing because we don't have huge tires, but bigger ones. And anytime you compress and you're like, you got the wheel turned, you get the,
That's a great noise. Just kidding. Yeah,
is it going to puncture the tire this time or next time? When are we going to lose the tire here?
Well, that's like, you know, going back to why I always ask people like, okay, what's your goals? What's your objectives for the build? Which I think are great questions to ask for anything in life, because then you get you'll get an idea of like, okay, they want showroom quality. They're not going to be driving this off-road, or you're going to get somebody, you know what? I want to be able to drive this every day, but I also want to take this, you know, off-roading, or I want to take it hunting, whatever it may be. And that way you get a better idea of like, okay, well, this is the direction I would recommend.
Yeah. Love it. Well, we've got people that are listening, either the people that skipped ahead when I mentioned it at the front, or we have just, you know, the 15 diehard classic car off-road, you know, restoration folks. So if you're still with us, awesome. We'll get into some business stuff. Walt, give me kind of the quick backstory of how you got into the business. I know it was a family business, but maybe, you know, just very high story of how it started, how you came in your involvement.
Yeah. So Tom's Off Road was founded in 1976 by my father, Tom. My dad, it was one of those things. It was a kind of a side hustle for him initially, a passion project, something that he just really enjoyed. And how it all started is he had his first Bronco. He was hunting with some friends and he accidentally rolled his Bronco, which he's done a couple times to different Broncos. So it started off as a personal problem for him because he was like, oh man, I need some parts because I want to fix my Bronco for the damage that I did when I rolled it. So he started calling around to junkyards and he was able to track down parts and able to fix it up and restore it and get it back into pretty much the original condition that it was before the rollover. Word kind of got out, and once a friend that was like, hey, I need some Bronco parts because this broke, or, you know, I busted this. And they're like, oh, you should talk to Tom. And then a light bulb went on in my dad's head. I was like, I'm going to start doing this. You know, he was so busy in his backyard that the neighbors actually filed a complaint to the city saying, hey, they're running a business. They're making too much noise. Like, can you please ask them to stop? And so that's when my dad decided, you know what? I'm going to rent out my first physical location for the store. And so he started working 50% at the Bronco shop, 50% at Chevron. And then eventually, I was a toddler when he decided to make the jump full-time into the Bronco business. So it was something long-term my dad didn't anticipate doing for his whole life. He just was like, well, let's give it, see if it lasts 5-10 years, because he just really enjoyed it. My experience, how I got involved with the shop, this was actually my first job. So I was working in the back of the warehouse doing receiving, inventory, manufacturing, assembly. So just kind of doing everything that needed to be done in order to get parts out the door. So it was a great way to really learn the business and get more familiar with early Broncos and just really hands-on every day, get to like touch and feel the product, which was really fun to do. My dad was retiring, so there's an opportunity for my brother and I to take over the business. So my brother, Mark, and I decided together to take over the business, and that's how we got to where we are today.
Hey, Andrew here with a quick sidebar. I want to introduce you to Daniel, the owner of dayspringpens.com, where they sell, not shockingly, pens and pen accessories. Daniel's an incredibly kind and gracious guy. Was hugely helpful in terms of helping people with the lay of the land at our recent, or not so recent, Norfolk event for ECF Live. But here's what he had to say about his experience with E-Commerce Fuel, our private embedded community for 7- and 8-figure owners.
E-Commerce Fuel was one of the first forums or communities for entrepreneurs that I found out about when I switched over from my original career into e-commerce and business. And I didn't know it at the time, but it very quickly would become a true north for me and the business, where every business decision that I would make, every strategic decision for advancement or growth, it was a place that I could go and rely on the wisdom of the forum. And that trust has just been huge and has helped grow the business over time. So over the last 4 years, we've more than doubled in size from a top line perspective in our business. We've done things like replatform on Shopify, grow content marketing, engage AI to like leverage, reduce labor costs, all the way down to personal finance, things like credit card reward hacking, tax strategies, things that enhance not just the business, but also as an owner, they help me strategically engage with my family life and my personal life in a way that I wasn't sure was ever possible when I was first getting started. You'd be very hard pressed to find a group of more engaged, thoughtful and expert individuals than you do at E-Commerce Fuel. And I'm exceedingly grateful for being a part of the community.
After hearing literally hundreds of comments like this over the last decade our community's been around, it's easy to offer our 10x guarantee. If you don't get at least a 10x ROI on your membership in the first year, in terms of increased revenue, saved time, and saved money, we'll give you a full refund plus an extra $1,000. But many of our members report seeing massive value in just the first month or two when applying it to their 7- or 8-figure business. You can learn more about the community and apply for membership at ecommercefuel.com. Okay, back to the show. Prepping for this, one thing I thought was really interesting is the way you think about culture at Tom's, and particularly compensation. Like, I feel like compensation is a tricky thing. Like, there's a psychology behind it. There's, you know, does actually, you know, paying people more for certain tasks work, or is it actually counterproductive? And there's just it's such a complex thing. How do you think about compensation? And maybe you could talk specifically about how you think about separating cost of living adjustments versus raises versus bonuses, all that kind of stuff. What's your philosophy there?
Part of my dad being a great business person was just the way he was able to build this culture of Tom's Off-Road and to build the team. We have very low turnover. And for example, like there's besides my brother and I, there's 4 other team members on our leadership team, and they all have 20 plus years of experience here. So it's one of those things where my dad, I feel like he still says this to me, but it's like, you know, make sure you're paying people what they're worth. And so that means, you know, that it's going to be beneficial for the company, because you're making sure that, you know, whatever value that they're bringing, they're being equally compensated for it. And that team member, they're feeling, okay, I'm also being paid what I'm worth, all the things that I'm bringing to the company, like the company recognizes that. But the hard question is, okay, then how do you determine what that value is? So that's something I've been really working on these last like 4 years. And a couple months ago, we shared a compensation philosophy document with our team. It was an idea I got from the ECF community. There was a thread talking about compensation, and someone mentioned like, oh, we did this just so it's very clear. Like, in order, if you want to make more, these are things that we are looking for. I would say it's one of those things where high level, I'm trying to stay around that 20%-ish, like, the total cost of labor of our gross sales. I'm trying to say around 20%, but we want to make sure that we are paying a livable wage. And so we definitely pay above the average for our market. And then also we tie our performance bonuses to, you know, the performance of the company, but also the performance of the team member. And that's something historically I feel like we've been very generous with bonuses. So when the company is doing well, we really do share the profits with everyone.
And how do you structure that from a bonus and a race perspective? And like you mentioned, we give people bonuses based on how the company is doing and how they're doing. But how do you actually, when you sit down with, I don't know if you do it quarterly or every, you know, 6 months or year, whatever it is, when you have that meeting, what are you talking through when you say, hey, here's what you get because of how the company did, and here's what you get because of your performance? How does that formula work?
So it's a percentage of our net profit is what is eligible for the pool of bonuses. So depending on, that's how successful the company is. And then how successful the team member is, we do annual performance reviews twice a year. And those are done by the person's direct report, their manager. So it's one of those things where everyone gets scored. And then like based on your score, that's where, you know, if you get, we have like five different tiers. If you're in tier one, you get 100% of your eligible bonus. If you're in, you know, tier two, you get like 90%, tier three, you get like 75%, and so on down the board. I can't remember the exact percentages off the top of my head. But so, and what we do as well, it's like not just one person is, you know, impacting a person's bonus. So we also have a person who's conducting the performance review, that manager, they share it with their manager. And actually as the whole leadership team, we review, because right now we're at 36 team members. We review all the performance reviews just to make sure like, hey, is this based on what we observed, based on what we've known, talking with other people, like, is this a fair assessment of this person, making sure they weren't graded too easily or making sure they weren't graded too hard, and that will determine what they're eligible for their bonus. So we've tweaked this over the years, but like we used to do like quarterly, but now we do the bonuses annually just because we want to make sure that, you know, it's a true reflection of the company's performance. Because, you know, you could have a really great, you know, Q1 and Q2 and then like tank in Q3 and Q4. And then it's like, oh man, we gave way too many bonuses to people in that first. It's like, so we just want to make sure it's sustainable for the company, you know, and fair too, to the team members, that they're getting what they deserve.
When you do pay out those bonuses for the profit sharing, is the entire, so you get the pool, you know, let's say, you know, X percent, 5% or 10%, whatever it is, the company's profits go into a pool. And then do they get a guaranteed percent regardless of performance based on how the company did? Or is that pool that they get a pro rata percentage of the company pool, and then the entire percent is based on their performance? Like, is there any part that's not linked to performance, is just linked to company performance?
Everything is linked to performance because we have all our managers do at least monthly. A lot of them are biweekly, sometimes even weekly check-ins with team members. So our thing is we don't want anyone having a low enough performance that they're not going to get a bonus at all, because that's going to be a big issue for them and for the company. So we really like to address any performance issues that need to be addressed in real time. So that way we can correct that behavior. So it's really to motivate the managers, but to motivate the team members as well of like, hey, my performance matters. So rarely do we have somebody, you know, we rank everyone 1 to 5, 5 being the best, 1 being bad, and 3 being like, hey, average. You're just, you know, you're checking the boxes. You're doing what you're supposed to. So like we rarely have people get scored below a 3. And then usually most people are like 3s and 4s or sometimes 4s and 5s. So it's one of those things where more often than not, people are across the board are getting a majority, if not all of the bonus that they're eligible for, because it's something culturally, we just keep everyone accountable. And, you know, we instill that into our leaders that like, hey, like if you see an issue or you have a performance issue, like, you know, don't wait to fix it in 3 weeks when you have your monthly check-in, like, fix it today. So that's something why we decided to have it all tied to performance review. And like, you know, nothing is just, oh, 20% of your bonus, whatever you're eligible for, is guaranteed. And then the other 80% is based on performance. So yeah, it's all 100% based on performance. And then also it's based on your job level as well. We want to encourage our team members to be like, if you want to find a way to make more, let's talk about it. Let's put together a professional development plan. Let's put together some, you know, stretch projects. Let's put together some goals, and like, let's find some ways for you to actually, you know what you need to do on a day-to-day perspective. And we're in agreement of like, hey, this is the direction, you know, you want to head. Cause there's some people here that it's like, you know what? I'm happy. They get to a certain level and that's 100% great. totally support that. And then you have some people who are like, hey, I want to keep growing. I want to be a leader. I want to do this. So it's like, okay, so here are some things that, you know, we want to see you as a leader. Like, are you encouraging other team members? Are you supporting other team members? Are you making a positive impact on the culture here? Like, things that we're looking for, like, okay, like, if you can't do this when you're not a manager, when you're not a leader, like, how are you going to be able to do this when you're managing and leading people? So it's okay to talk about your compensation. Like, if you feel like you should be paid more, like, talk to your manager, talk to myself, talk to the leadership team, and like, we want to be on the same page with you. So like, we'll be honest with you, we'll be transparent, and we'll tell you like, okay, if you want to get here, here are the things that you need to do. So it's really just, I feel like, trying to not let just raises happen just because of time, if that makes sense, or just like, you know, just organically. It's like, we want to be intentional about when we give a raise, and we want our team members to be intentional about how they are growing professionally. It just doesn't happen, I guess, is what I'm trying to get at. Like, you can't just let it happen organically.
Yeah, it's just not a butt in seat automatic thing.
Yep, exactly.
When I think about this kind of business, I actually looked at years and years ago when I was thinking about buying another business. I looked at a business, not directly similar, but kind of in the same vein, like automotive, some parts for kind of older vehicles. And the plus side was, you have this oftentimes, this customer base of you know, rabidly passionate people about things, right? Like, you know how much people pour into their Broncos, especially their classic Broncos. It is, can be insane. And so that's a great side. But one of the downsides was the number of SKUs that they had to manage. Like, when you think about the number of parts that go into a car, it's just mind-boggling. And so from an inventory perspective, that's one of the reasons I passed on that potential opportunity. It's like, there's just so many SKUs to deal with here anyway, am I thinking about the dynamics, at least of those two dynamics of the business correctly?
Oh yeah, 100%. There's, I'd say, multiple times a week where I'm like, oh, you look at another business, it's like, it'd be so nice just to have five SKUs, or like only sell clothing and shoes. So it's like, it's much easier to manage and, you know, control costs and just streamline, you know, packaging, shipping, all that stuff. So yes, that is definitely something that is, I would say, top of mind for myself, for our leadership team, for our managers here, for everyone. It's like, inventory is very, very important. Not only, you know, how much do we have of it, but also how we manage it, how we, you know, how efficient we are of our inventory turns. But yeah, we have thousands and thousands of SKUs in our warehouse. So it's one of those things, like, if you wanted to, you could build the Bronco from the ground up and like order, you know, every part. And it's one of those things where it's interesting, because you do have some customers that they do want to do that. You do have some customers that want to, you know, find that middle ground. And something that's really cool, we have a couple of partners that we work with. So we offer, you could buy a rolling chassis from us, and you can also buy a body tub. And like, you know, you get those two things and you're pretty close to having a full Bronco. Like, you know, you do obviously have some wiring, some electrical work to do, and some interior work, but like, it really helps speed up the process. So, but yeah, it's one of those things. It's a challenge, because we want to be able to be that one-stop shop for anyone looking to restore a Bronco, because we want to be, you know, to provide that convenience, to provide that customer service where they don't need to go anywhere else. They can get everything that they need from us. And that's like one of, you know, the pillars my dad used to found the company, is just having the high regard for customer service and doing everything we can to make the customer experience amazing from the first time they talk to us, from the time they get their part. And then also, it's like one of those things, like, when you buy a part from us, it's not just transactional. It's not just, we ship it out and it's like, hey, good luck. We're here for everyone. So it's like, customers often become friends because we talk with them so much, and you can actually pick up a phone and talk to a person, and we can help troubleshoot, walk you through a product if you have an issue installing it, or just whatever is going on with your Bronco. Like, we provide technical support. We just don't provide a service in terms of just a product.
It's so interesting from the marketing. So you mentioned customer service and the full restorations. As marketers, it's always interesting to put yourself in the customer side of things. And just recently with our restoration, there's two companies I've been watching for years, right? Because this has been in the back of my mind, restoration, for ever since the first time it broke down, right? I was like, okay, someday we're going to do this. Finally, someday came. And so there's been two companies I've been watching, right? And I've been watching all their stuff, reading their, for years and years and years, get to the point where I'm going to do it. And I call them up. And the company I thought I was going to go with, you learn so much about a company if you're thinking about doing something like this in just a 20-minute phone call, right? So much, right? And like one brand just knocked it out of the park and the other brand didn't. They were kind of distracted and kind of like, you know, even though we made an appointment with them, they're like, oh, sorry, I don't have a lot of time. Like, you just, anyway, so going to your point about customer service, the attribution window was like 4 years for me, for these guys. And two, the customer service sealed the deal at the end of the day.
Totally. Well, and like, you know, historically, the early Bronco market, we've been fortunate where, you know, we've had only a handful of competitors in the market. But as the early Broncos been growing in popularity, you see larger aftermarket automotive companies now carrying Bronco parts. So customer service becomes even more important because there's more options where people can shop these days. And also, it's one of those things where, you know, the biggest difference that we can provide our competitive advantage is that we know Broncos inside and out. We can tell you about every part on the Bronco. You know, we are Bronco experts, where some of these larger companies, they wouldn't be able to speak to Broncos like we do. And also, since we're a smaller company, we are able to provide a more boutique customer service experience.
How do you, so you mentioned a rolling chassis. So I can go and buy, when you say a rolling chassis, the frame, obviously all the suspension parts, drivetrain, engine, even everything?
Yep, the engine, wow. Fuel tanks, tires and wheels, like, you know, it becomes, you literally can just put your body tub, you can set it on the rolling chassis. It's ready.
That's amazing. And is it, do you have those in stock or is that a custom order kind of thing?
So that's a custom order kind of thing. So, but you can order them, you know, over the phone, or you can literally order it off our website. And then the body tubs we do have in stock. So we usually, we definitely carry a handful of those in stock. But yeah, they've been, let's see here, I think we've been doing it for about, the body tubs for about 2 years now, and it's been going really well. They've been selling very consistently, and it's one of those things where the nice thing about keeping them in stock is a big issue a lot of people find, especially if you're an individual trying to buy a body tub. Like, it can be anywhere from, you know, a month to 6 month wait because people are so backed up. So that's like another thing, is the convenience. That's something that's really important to us, going back to the inventory, is having that item in stock. Because like for our customers, the most important things, there's three things. It's the price of the product, is it available, and how much does it cost to ship? And those three things are something, you know, we're always talking about and always looking at from a strategic standpoint on a daily basis.
I wish I could buy a drivetrain like a chassis, because it's beautiful. Because if you have your own chassis that's got the memory, because if you're connected emotionally to a vehicle, you're not going to be connected to the underside. You're going to be connected to the body, you know, the and that. And so, being able to just be like, hey, I'm going to keep this. You send me a good brand new to go. That's where 80% of your issues are going to be. Yep. Oh, dreamy, man.
That's wonderful. Well, it's cool too. In our showroom, we moved locations. We've always been in Medford, but we moved locations about 2.5 years ago, and a lot more space, which is great. And then a lot more office space. And then also we actually have like a true showroom for the first time. So it's really exciting. So we actually have our Rolly chassis and our body tub displayed in the showroom. And it's so funny to watch people walk in through the front door. It's like the rolling chassis is a magnet. They're just like, oh, what's over here? Like, and that's the first thing everyone goes to. And then usually after that, it's the body tub, which is right next to it. So yeah, it's a really cool thing to, like, you know, it's, you get to see how the sausage is made. You know, and it's one of those things where it's just like, it definitely, every time I walk by it, because it's on the path to like our kitchen, break room, and bathroom, I always look at it. And it's like, every time I'm inspired, I'm like, ah, someday I'm going to build a rolling chassis from the ground up. Once the kids get older, maybe.
From a manufacturing perspective, thousands of SKUs is, you know, in kind of the businesses I've seen that serve other classic cars and vintage cars like this, there's always often a combination of things that, you know, I'd say probably 80% of the products are people are products, because you can't, I'm guessing you're not manufacturing 2,000 plus, you know, thousands and thousands of parts. So 80-90% are ones that you buy wholesale. And then you have, you know, maybe 5, 10, 15% of products that are like uniquely yours that you have created for your own whatever purposes. Is that kind of the mix of how you're doing? How much are you buying versus manufacturing?
Yeah, it's definitely a combination. You know, the answer would have been different if you had asked me this question 10 years ago, 20 years ago for the company. We definitely have gone a lot more direct to the manufacturer. So there are a majority of our products that there's, you know, no middle person. We're not buying from a distributor, and we have that relationship with the manufacturer, which is really important because building that relationship, you know, it's more of a partnership where it's the understanding of, hey, the more successful that Tom's Off-Road is, the more successful the manufacturer is going to be because we're going to order more parts or we're going to build new products with you. So we're always looking at like, okay, because there's kind of two buckets when it comes to manufacturing. It's like, all right, what's a need that's not currently being solved by current products, or what is a need that's not being served by a product that already exists? So we're always looking at like, okay, what's something new we can bring to the table? What's something that we can improve to, you know, make it, you know, better performance, better aesthetics? You know, it could be a variety of things. We do a lot of business. We have some great fabricators that we work with directly, great manufacturers across the board, you know, from plastic, glass, metal, electrical, you name it. And we tried, it's been interesting because, you know, 20 years ago, most of our manufacturers were stateside. And also part of that was because we were buying more from distributors. But now we try to manufacture as much as we can in the US. But unfortunately, there's just some items where you literally can't find anyone to manufacture it because there's just no capabilities for manufacturing in the US. So we're forced to go overseas. So we have a combination, a mix of where products are manufactured. But like, it's really fun that we have all these different manufacturers that we consistently work with and have that partnership, because we're looking for partners in the long term. We're not looking for a manufacturer of like, oh, who can just make this the cheapest? Like, we want consistency and we want great quality, because we want all of our products to be great quality products, so that people know that when they install this on the Bronco, they won't have to worry about it not working like the way it should. So yeah, so manufacturing is really interesting. So yeah, we actually don't manufacture anything in-house. We do some light manufacturing. So it might be, you know, kitting up things that come from different suppliers, or it might be adding some things on to that where we just want the quality control just to make sure that the part's going to work. And we also do some light assembly as well. So there's some things that you can order from us that require some customization specifically for your Bronco. So we have an awesome team of mechanics that can, you know, fix anything on a Bronco. And so there are some things that we do that are fully customizable for our customers.
Reading between the lines, I mean, if I had to just guess, correct me if I'm wrong here, but it sounds like you work with dozens of manufacturers across, you know, maybe mostly I'm guessing in Asia, but maybe, you know, 20-30% or a minority in the United States. What have you learned about, because that seems like so many different relationships to manage, so many different products to manage. And also even the iteration and the back and forth, right? Like doing something in-house, you can iterate so much more quickly. You get a sample, you try it, you tweak it. But when you're overseas, like that slows down the process exponentially. What have you learned about making that work? Because in theory, that sounds amazing, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like, hey, we've got all these partners. But when I think about the problems, I'm just going to throw a bunch out there and you can address them however you want. I think about, okay, how do we make sure that this doesn't, once a partner has this, how do they not go and sell it to other people? How are they not selling direct? How do we deal with quality control? How do we just, as a company that's a medium-sized company, but not a massive company, deal with dozens of manufacturing partners? Like, what have you learned over the years about making that all work?
A lot of trial and error. And like, the first thing is like, I would say making sure you have the right team internally in place to handle that. And, you know, the right structure, you know, the right headcount. So like, we have a team, like I said before, we have R&D, we have purchasing, we have inventory, we have an engineer. So it's one of those things, like all those people are involved working with these manufacturers in some shape or form. Some are more direct, some are more indirect, but it's really making sure that you have your own internal process dialed. And also then the second would be communication with those manufacturers, the suppliers, and really just being upfront about, hey, this is what we're looking for. Here's our goals and objectives. Like, does this work for you? And finding ways to align on goals and objectives, so you're on the same page. Cause I feel like sometimes companies and manufacturers can be working against each other. And it's like, we always want to be a partner and we want to find long-term manufacturers. So it's kind of like back to your example, you know, finding, you know, vetting companies for your van about like, oh, this was a great fit, this wasn't. We do the same with manufacturers. We test the waters. We have, you know, if it's going to be a new manufacturer, we're looking at a handful of them and we all say like, hey, can you give us a sample of this XYZ product? And we compare and see like, okay, what's going to be a good fit. So yeah, communication is key, and aligning on the same goals so you're working together is huge. And then lastly, it's really just building relationships. So just like we do with our customers, we want to build relationships. We just don't want it to be a transaction. So the same thing like with our manufacturers, they are our partners, and we want to, you know, understand like, hey, like, what can we do to help your business grow? What can we do to help you be successful? But also at the same time, like, hey, we want to get to know you. Like, what are you passionate about? Like outside of work, like family, friends, activities, whatever it is. Cause again, it goes back to that relationship. So I think the relationship piece is key. Having that relationship allows you to have better communication, and it also allows you to be honest. And that's like the biggest thing. One of my favorite manufacturers that we work with tariffs going on and everything, we were just like, hey, it's going to be really hard to keep ordering the same quantity just with the new tariffs. So our POs might be a little bit smaller. And so they're like, we kind of asked like, hey, what can we do to work together to find a solution? We ate half the new tariff costs. They ate half the new tariff costs. They promised, you know what, for a year, we won't raise prices on you guys. And then after that year, they're like, okay, like we were expanding into some new products. They're like, do these prices and quantities work? And we're like, ah. Like, can we work out a better price and better quantities? Because it was just too much of an initial investment for some of these new products that we're bringing to market. And they're like, okay, we understand that. We know you're testing the market. So we'll get rid of the MOQs and we'll do whatever you guys want. And we'll actually give you the same price of what we were going to give you for, you know, 100, 200 of this one product. So it's one of those things, by having those relationships, like if you wouldn't be able to do that, you wouldn't be able to work together, you wouldn't be able to negotiate, because that's one of the things with, you know, our products is just like a lot of companies out there, tariffs have really impacted our business. And we want to do everything possible that we can to not have to raise prices, because we don't want to pass that price on to customers. Even though, you know, a lot of brands have already done that, that's something that we are actively doing our best to keep prices as low as possible. And we're only able to do that by obviously, you know, impacting like, okay, how can we reduce the price of our, you know, the cost of goods sold?
How much would you say on the tariff front impacted so many people listening? But if you had to guess, obviously there's a lot of noise and variability, sales go up or down. But if you could take a carbon copy of last year versus this year, hold everything else constant, just based on tariffs, how much do you think that's eating into your bottom profitability at the end of the year in terms of percentage?
I would say we saw on average a 10 to 12% reduction in our gross margins across the board.
I want to talk about a little bit of marketing.
Yeah.
What's working well at Tom's right now? Like maybe you could start with what your marketing mix looks like. Always think it's fascinating. I'm guessing word of mouth, given you've been around for 30 plus years in a very, very concentrated market, is a pretty meaningful driver. Give us a sense of your marketing mix and what is working, especially now on the digital side that you're playing with and that's showing results.
Marketing has been interesting here. It'd be really interesting to chart out what marketing has looked like through the years, because for so long, yeah, it has been word of mouth, where, you know, fortunately we're in a niche industry and, you know, having a good brand reputation, you do get a lot of referrals, which is great. And we still do. Historically, we haven't had to directly compete in terms of marketing with our direct competitors. Now we have to, because it's just the nature of the game. So that's unfortunate. So our marketing budget is much higher than it used to be, even, you know, 5-7 years ago. And so our marketing mix, we do a lot. We have a great creative and marketing team. And like, I think people would be surprised by the, you know, how efficient we are with the size of team that we have. Our marketing mix, we got photography in-house, we got videography in-house, we got editing in-house, both for photo and video in-house. We also manage our Shopify e-com platform. We also have a graphic designer in-house. So it's really nice to have this creative control over everything. But yeah, you know, we really focus on do email sends, social media, paid advertisement, organic. We do Facebook and Instagram primarily, and then YouTube as well, because there's just a lot of video content of how-tos, tips, instructional install videos that we love to share with our customers. And then also we do a lot of paid search as well for our marketing. We do events as well. So we host our own event, and we also attend, on an average year, 12 plus events across the country that are Bronco specific.
of all those that you mentioned, which one do you feel like you get the best bang for the buck for, and which one has really struggled in the last year to produce results?
Oh, and I forgot one other one. We also have blogs on our website as well.
Blogs, that's not a word. That's not a word you hear very often these days.
No, it isn't. But it's funny because just again, it's just the nature of our product. You do have a lot of people who search terms or the things that they're looking for are very blog friendly to help improve your SEO or email sends. We have great metrics on our email sends, and it's something it's fun to do a lot of A/B testing with. That's something we do internally as well. So we're always playing around with time of the day of the week, the content. There's just endless possibilities that we're still testing, and something we've before, like, it's again going back to like needing to be more proactive with our marketing. We would do a handful of marketing emails a year, maybe once a quarter. And they're usually really focused around some of our big sales. We're now, we're doing at least a few a week, and we're even trying to increase that frequency and trying to create more articles, not just around our products, not just around our sales, but more around our services, things people may not know or they're aware of that we offer. Supporting events, Bronco events across the country is another big important thing to us. But also just getting more editorial. So talking about people's Broncos at the shop, what they like about it, their journey with the Bronco, their build, but also getting a chance to highlight customers as well. Because our customers have so many amazing stories about what the Bronco means to them, but also about, their personal experience with restoring their Bronco as well. So it's something that's really a fun thing to do as well. I'm involved with the emails, and it's really fun to be able to share other people's Bronco stories with our community. And then something that's been a big challenge is paid advertising, specifically like with Google. It's just one of those things, again, going back to our market becoming much more competitive and larger companies entering the market. It's just one of those things where we wouldn't have to spend that much and be able to get a great return. And so like it was almost like now like our monthly budget is what we would spend in 1 year, 5 years ago. So it's just crazy how the costs keep increasing. And our biggest challenge is opportunities. Like, okay, how do we make sure these dollars are getting spent the most wisely and the most efficiently? And so I always love, I feel like Google's answer is like, oh, just increase the budget. That's always their answer, their magical answer to fix any of the problems. And it's like, well, in theory, that'd be great if you could guarantee us some results by increasing the budget. So yeah, that's something else. Like, we do manage the spend, or I should say we were involved with the digital, the paid advertising spend in-house, but also we work with an agency on that because it's something that we needed to outsource just because it has become so essential to a marketing mix, but also since it's become such a larger percentage of our marketing budget, we really wanted to make sure the dollars are getting spent appropriately.
I know you have got you've built up a lot of expertise around sourcing products, about manufacturing, and you've got a side project that you're working on the with those in terms of cars, parts, manufacturers, Asia. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, definitely. So it's just one of those things I'm always looking for interesting things to do. The name of the company is called Global Marketing Translations, so GMT for short. And I just saw that there's a big need of manufacturers overseas being able to communicate the value of their product to companies. Basically, I've been in the marketing world since college, and then also been in the automotive world for, I'm dating myself here, at least 15 years. So it's one of those things that's like, okay, what can, what's my expertise? Kind of what's my angle? What's my niche that I could provide a great service to and make a big impact for other companies out there? And also at the same time, it's compatible with Tom's Off-Road because it's one of those things where, hey, if I can help these manufacturers be more successful and help their business grow, like it's going to help us grow in return as well.
I feel like that build your net worth outside of your business. I think doing both is important, but I feel like that's one of the best, one of my biggest, strongest beliefs about entrepreneurship is don't just double down on everything I think there's a time to do that for the first year, two or three, like there's definitely a period, but to do that in the medium to long run and continue to just double, triple, quadruple, 10x down over 5 to 10 years, Yeah, maybe it works out great. Maybe it all ends beautifully when you exit for hundreds of millions of dollars. Maybe it doesn't, right? So I always try to give him credit. Roman Khan gave a great talk a couple of years ago at UCF Live. It's always been a core philosophy of mine, but he vocalized it really eloquently and it framed it up well. So yeah, 100% with you there. Walt, last question for you. You've got a few kids, so they're going to be around for a while, raising them in Oregon. Rumors that you may be piecing out to Portugal at some point. What's the story there?
Yes. So that all started during the pandemic. It was a form of escapism of just thinking about, okay, if we were to live somewhere else, where would we want to live? And based on like my wife and I, like lifestyle or activities, like Portugal was the place where we landed. And part of that is like we both, my wife and I, we just love traveling. We love experiencing, getting to meet new people, culture, you know, food. Like it's one of those things that really not only is like life-giving, but it's also like it gives you a better appreciation or better perspective on the world.
Well, man, thank you so much. It's been fun geeking out about cars, about marketing, about comp, about, you know, becoming James Bond in our retirements. And if you are listening, even if you don't love Broncos, even if you don't love classic cars, go check out tomsoffroad.com. They got some very cool things. And yeah, if you are interested in looking for, you know, a totally rebuilt chassis, maybe that's you. That's probably 1% of our listeners. Pretty cool you do that. So, well, amazing meeting at UCF Live. Thank you for being part of the community. Anything else you want to say here in parting before we wrap up?
Yeah, I just want to say thank you, Andrew, for the time. It's always fun chatting with you. Really appreciate it. I do wish we had more time, like you said, but also just want to give a shout out to this ECF podcast. It's been a great listen. It's just really cool to be on one of the episodes, but also for those who may be listening who aren't part of the ECF community, like I would highly recommend to check it out. I've only been a part for about 6 months now, but it's an amazing community. People really do care. Not only do they care, they really want to help people succeed. And just, it's really fun to have a place of like-minded individuals that have this, you know, similar goals in life, but also, you know, a place where you can share successes, you can share your failures, you can find encouragement, you can find wisdom. It's just, it's a really amazing place, a place I haven't been able to find anything like it anywhere else. So if you're looking, if you're a business owner, an e-com business owner, and you're looking for that type of community, you're just looking for support, you're looking for a sounding board, like, it's a amazing place to check out. It's one of those things I can't just say enough. I love the ECF community. It's a great place.
Man, well, thank you, sir. This has been a blast. We'll have to do it again.
That sounds good. Thanks, Andrew. Take care.
If you're an entrepreneur who wants to connect with other experienced owners who are working to build a financially vibrant business alongside a rich, meaningful life, head on over to ecommercefuel.com to learn more and connect with 1,000 entrepreneurs just like you. Work hard, adventure often, and forge what matters. Look forward to seeing you again next Friday.